I don't have a clock on the wall anymore, so buckle in. You might be here for a while. No, I'll watch my recorder here. You'll let me know. Okay, good. I'm going to talk about the continued progress of the church in the Roman Empire during the second and third centuries. We're talking broadly about the period of time from 100 AD to 311 AD. The reason we pick those dates in particular is that 100 AD approximately is when John the Apostle died, give or take a few years. He was the oldest and the last of the apostles to be alive. John was. We're not sure exactly. We know he was alive in the late 90s. We have contemporary reports from from church fathers. From the end of the apostolic era to 311 AD, that was the year before Christianity was legalized in the Roman Empire. 312 was the Edict of Milan, which we'll talk about more next time. So that's, you know, a period of church under Rome, the second and third centuries, 100 to 311 AD. The spread of Christianity through the Roman Empire during that 200-year period has to be regarded as one of the most important trends in all of human history. It transformed the Roman Empire, and it transformed the world. Again, last time, it's somewhat speculative to know how many Christians there were at the end of the first century. We don't have records, so it is speculative. But the estimates range from 100,000 to 500,000 Christians in the Roman Empire at the end of the first century. The Roman Empire had a population of about 100 million at that time, and the Roman Empire comprised about a third of the population of the whole world. So there are maybe 300 million people alive at that time. 100 million of them were in the Roman Empire. And of that 100 million, you know, again, something like 0.1% to 0.5% were Christian. Christianity was a largely insignificant force in the Roman Empire at the end of the first century. Many Romans would not have even known that Christianity existed. It had very little official attention. There were no edicts. There was no prohibitions against Christianity. There were no policies in place for dealing with them. There had been no official persecution, with the exception of that brief stint in Rome under Nero, when he found it handy to scapegoat them for the fire in Rome. But again, that was just in the city of Rome, and it was only very temporary. At the end of the third century, we think something like 10% of the population was Christian by then. 10 million people. Huge growth. Again, we don't know for sure, absolutely, but we know better what kind of population was Christian by that time. Christianity was very well known, highly controversial, a powerful force for good or evil in the Roman Empire, depending on which side of that fence you sat on. But the whole Christian question was a very big deal, to the degree that Constantine the Great, in 312 AD, believing that it would shore up his claim to Rome, and perhaps even more so, believing that Christianity had the intellectual and spiritual vitality to rejuvenate the Roman Empire, adopted Christianity himself and promoted it very strongly in the empire. And he was right. The adoption of Christianity into the Roman Empire that probably gave the Roman Empire another century, because it was on its last legs in 312. And also, as we pointed out before, that even that 10% doesn't fully capture the impact of Christianity, because Christianity wasn't spread evenly. Christianity was highly concentrated in certain geographical areas, certain cities. It was mostly in the cities, by the way. You know the term pagan? We're all familiar with that term. That comes from the Latin word pagani, which means country folk, country people. That's what the word pagan literally means. And the reason that is because it was in rural areas where the old religion persisted the longest. So country people tended to still worship the old gods. Having lived in cities and country and in the country, I can tell you it's true. Country people tend to be a lot more conservative than city people. And that can be a double-edged sword, you know, because in the days of the Roman Empire, it was the conservatives that held on to the old gods and were unwilling to even consider anything new that were, you know, and so that's why they came to be called pagans, pagani, country people. So in some, Alexandria, Rome, Antioch, places like that, Christianity was sometimes, it might have been close to half the population in some of those cities by the end of the third century. Now, how did that spread? And here's one of the remarkable things about the rapid spread of Christianity was that there appeared to be very little missionary activity during this period. It does not appear to have spread mostly by organized efforts by the church to spread it. We don't have, you know, again, we don't have a lot of records through all this period, but from what we do, and the further on we go in this period, the more we do know about what things were like. But there doesn't appear to be, you know, there was the, even in the first century, we talk about the work of the apostles going around and, but most of the spread of Christianity, even during the first century, would have been person to person, one at a time, people talking to their families, people talking to their friends, the natural movements of people from one place to another due to, you know, economic reasons, famines, depressions, wars that would, you know, naturally move populations or individuals from one place to another. Commercial trades, you look at, you know, the couple, kind of the power couple of the New Testament, Priscilla and Aquila, right, who were, they were merchants, and they got around, and they, all over the Roman Empire, all over the Mediterranean world they traveled, and it appeared that they spread and supported Christianity everywhere they went. So it was that sort of thing, mostly, that spread Christianity. Most of Christianity actually probably was in Asia Minor. Asia Minor was probably the most Christian part of the empire through to the end of this period. Asia Minor, that's what's now Turkey, the Anatolian Peninsula. There was a large population in Rome. Might have been as many as 50,000 Christians in Rome of a city of a population of around 1 million. There were large churches in Spain, in Egypt, in North Africa. In the year 258 A.D., there was a synod in North Africa that attracted 87 bishops. There were a lot in North Africa. As we said last time, it was much smaller. It had way slow going in certain areas, especially areas that had very strong attachments to their traditions, to their culture and civilization. So it spread very slowly in Greece. There wasn't much Christianity in Greece for quite a while. There were some places, there were some cities, Corinth, you know, but nothing in Athens, you know. It was in Palestine. There was a big church in Jerusalem, but outside of Jerusalem, there was very little, almost nothing in Palestine as a whole, except for Jerusalem. After in Jerusalem, we talked about the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. That wasn't the end of the Jewish presence in Jerusalem. It wasn't the end of the Jewish wars. There was a further rebellion in 135 AD called the Bar Kokhba Revolt. It was an attempt to bring in a messianic state in Rome, in Jerusalem. And that was the final straw. You thought 70 AD was the final straw, but it wasn't. 135 AD was the final straw for the Romans. Not only did they raise Rome again, and enslaved maybe 250,000 Jews, they also made it illegal for Jews to ever go to Jerusalem. Except one day out of the year, the day that the temple was destroyed, they were allowed to go within sight of of Jerusalem in order to mourn. It was almost like Rome kind of rubbing their face in it. They renamed Jerusalem. Actually, that's when Judea got its present day name of Palestine. The name Palestine was a renaming of Judea by the Romans and they named it deliberately after the ancient enemy of the Judeans, the Philistines. They named it Palestine, again, in order to rub it in their face and try to just erase the Jewish existence because they were just so sick of the Jews at that point. There was a large Christian church, but they weren't Jews anymore. The Jews weren't allowed to live, and so there was a large Christian church in Jerusalem for many years after that. And they always had to have Gentile bishops in the church in Jerusalem until 325. There was an interesting case. The country of Armenia. The country of Armenia is in the Middle East. It's kind of between Turkey and Russia and Iraq. Armenia was the very first officially Christian nation in the world. A man named Gregory, he was exiled from Armenia. He went to Palestine for a time, lived in Caesarea, and became a Christian there. He went back in order to evangelize his Armenian countrymen, seemed to appear to have almost completely failed. And at one point, the king of Armenia buried him in a pit in the plains of Ararat in Armenia. It was a pit that he was thrown into, and he was just left there for, it was a 12-year sentence that he was imprisoned in this pit. After 8 years, that same king had apparently gone insane, and his advisors, his cabinet, decided that Gregory of Armenia, Gregory the Illuminator, being a holy man, might be able to cure the king of his insanity. So they brought him up out of the pit. And after 8 years of being in a pit, and he was apparently able to convert the king, that the king converted to Christianity and thus converted the whole country of Christianity, whole country. That was the way it often happened in those early days, that a king or a chieftain, a tribal, you know, warlord would become a Christian, maybe for various unscrupulous reasons sometimes. But the result would be that he would let the missionaries, let the monks and priests in, and they would come and they would start teaching, and pretty soon the whole nation would be. You think of the idea of the whole nation getting baptized because the king was baptized. That would be a very strange idea to us. However, we do believe in household baptisms. And in those days, a tribe or a nation, in a lot of ways, was viewed as a very large household. And the king was the father of that household. And so the king was baptized, and so all of his children were baptized as well. Again, it seems kind of strange to us, but the fact is that God used that an awful lot to spread Christianity. Now, again, obviously a lot of those people would only be superficial Christians, but not all of them. Some of them would really listen to the priests, and they'd really believe it. And that was one of the major ways Christianity, especially after the Roman period. It was always primarily a middle and lower middle class phenomenon. There were always some highly educated and wealthy, well-born converts, but it was mostly a middle and lower middle class phenomenon. There were occasions even in the emperor's household. There's a fascinating story. Philip the Arabian, who was the emperor of Rome between 244 and 249, was at the least very positive and curious about Christianity. He may have been a Christian himself. There's a wonderful story about Philip the Arabian walking into the church in Rome. And I'll explain that in a minute. Even though it was technically illegal, they still had official church meetings for some of this period. He walked into the church in Rome on Easter Sunday and wanted to participate. And the bishop, who was presiding, told him that he had to sit in the back because churches in those days were divided, and the front part would be for communicant members, and people in the back would be those people who were visitors, catechumens, people who were in training and so forth, or they were just curious. They actually made a physical difference in the church between those who were full members of the church and those who were not. They would have to sit in the back. And the emperor of Rome was made to sit in the back of the church by the bishop, which he apparently accepted graciously and sat in the back with the other catechumens. So, throughout the period, as I said, the Roman Empire was only held together by force. They had no common culture. They had no common ethnicity. They had no common ties. Most of, you know, the days when you could, you know, appeal to the patriotism of Romans was long past because most of them weren't Romans. You know, there were only a few, only a very small percentage of the Roman Empire would have been ethnically Roman or even ethnically Italian. Most of them were from other places. There were also a very large number of them were slaves. Something like a third to a half of the population of the Roman Empire at this time would have not been free. Now, being a slave, we could talk a lot about being a slave meant a lot of different things. It could be all the way down to being, you know, the guy on a chain gang out in a field harvesting, you know, with the whips behind him and being worked to death by the time he was 25. There was a lot of that. There were also slaves that were very trusted advisors and right-hand men of their, they were beloved servants that would often be adopted into the household as sons or freed upon their master's death or those sorts of things. So, it was, being a slave could be a great many things, but the one thing it all had in common was that they were not free. You know, they were not free to come and they were compelled to the service of their masters. And there were a lot of them. But the Roman Empire, it had very little. The Roman Empire was a disaster through most of this period. I mean, there were good emperors. There were a lot of bad emperors. There were civil wars, regular civil wars. There was a period in towards the middle of the middle and end of the third century when the Roman Empire very much appeared to have split into three different empires. And they were kind of able to bring it all back together again for a while. But it was violence all the time and corruption. The morals of the emperor were usually pretty terrible in the upper class. And that permeated down through, the whole, you know, there was just a, there just weren't a lot of good vital forces in the Roman Empire. Greek philosophy was spent, it was, you know, just wrangling over intellectual distinctions at this point. Nobody paid it much attention. It didn't have anything to tell people about how to live their lives, really. Judaism had a lot of appeal in the first century. As we said, in the days of Paul of Tarsus, Judaism was the fastest growing religion in the Roman Empire. It was very interesting to a lot of people for its high ethical standards, its high philosophical value, the idea of, you know, the pagan gods that were basically just like people except really strong and they were vindictive and they were petty and they were cruel and they committed incest and rape and all sorts of immorality and the pagan gods were not anything particularly worthy of emulation. So the God of the Old Testament is on a whole different level, right? So Judaism was very fascinating then, but everything that was fascinating about Judaism got carried into Christianity and even more so. And Judaism itself lost most of its appeal through the bigotry of the Jews and through the narrow legalism of the Pharisaical approach to the faith. You remember we talked about the Jews. The Jews didn't really want Gentiles in their faith because they didn't like Gentiles. They were the ones who said that, you know, the rabbi said that if a man was walking along the road and saw a Gentile woman giving birth at the side of the road, that he should let her die because it's better that she die than that another dog be born into the world. So you could see why that would limit the appeal of Judaism to some degree among the Gentile population. Christianity didn't have any of those baggage. It had all the benefits of Judaism without any of the baggage. Of course, Christianity actively taught the opposite. There's no Jew nor Greek, there's no slave nor free. Barbarian, Scythian, bond nor free, we're all one in Christ. So for all of those reasons, Christianity had a lot of, you know, the great intellectual force appeal to people throughout this period, and it spread rapidly. Now, the actual intellectual force of Christianity during the second and third period, interestingly, can't be compared either to what came before or what came after. The writers and theologians of this period are not the best. None of them, of course, can compare to the power and the force of the apostles. None of them can really compare to the force of the great theologians that came along in the 4th and 5th centuries, men like Augustine and Athanasius and people like that. So when we read the writings of people of this period, they are not the most impressive intellectually. But in terms of their faith and their love for one another, it's tough to find a period of Christianity that could equal it. They were remarkable men and women in a lot of ways, given what they endured, given what they accomplished during this period. People in the Roman Empire found it extremely strange that a Christian would call someone a brother and sister who they had just met, that were from a whole other land, that were a completely other nationality. People in the Roman Empire, even though it was a multi-ethnic place, people in the Roman Empire mostly kept to themselves. They kept to their own ethnicities. I mean, we see that even today. You know, you have a bunch of immigrants move into a particular area. You know, you'll have Chinatown, Little Italy. People kind of clump up. They tend to, even today. That was really true in the Roman Empire. They tended to worship separately, live separately, engage in commerce separately, speak separate languages. The idea of the church in Rome taking up an offering, a collection, for the relief of a famine in the church in Jerusalem struck them as almost scandalous, kind of obscene in a way, unnatural. And yet it was also a really powerful demonstration of the truth of what they were saying, of the unity of the human race in Christ, that Christ is going to overcome all the divisions and all the hatred and all the war and all those things. Something the Roman Empire was kind of desperately trying to do, because they had this whole empire full of people from different nationalities who mostly didn't have much to do with each other, but it made it very hard for them to have any sense of common purpose. Again, it was really only force holding the Roman Empire together through most of this period. The Christians didn't go to gladiator games. They didn't go to the races. They didn't engage in an awful lot of the public life. To be a Christian meant you got excluded from a lot of the public life of Rome, because the public life of Rome was full of immorality. Most religious services, many religious services, were something akin to orgies. That was common in pagan worship. So if you became a Christian, that meant somebody invites you to a birthday party and you couldn't go. Somebody invites you to a harvest festival. These things might seem innocuous to you of themselves, except those things would inevitably be worship services to particular gods that these people worshipped, with attendant immoral activities that would, you know, you read like in the book of 1 Corinthians, for example, there's a big discussion of how we think about meats offered to idols. It was a big question. To what degree can the Christian participate in, I mean, something Christians have always been? I think we're all very much confronted with that today as our culture becomes less and less Christian. What TV shows do we choose to watch or not watch? What events might we choose to forego? You know, I find when more and more sports activities are scheduled for Sundays, you know, people scheduling games and tournaments and things for Sundays, more and more Christians are having to say, well, I guess I can't be involved in organized sports then because I'm not going to miss church for an athletic event. So we're confronted with that here, and far more so, of course, in Rome. And so they called them haters of humanity, you know. It was one of the slurs. But at the same time, there was this fascination with what gives them, most people in Rome didn't really have much driving their lives other than the earthly desires, ambition and pleasure and wealth and so forth. And that all gets pretty empty. And so here were people that had something motivating them, driving them, that you couldn't understand. Why would people be willing to die for this? You know, it was an alien, you know. And so to people that had no purpose real or drive in their lives, even as they found them very odd and repulsive and even unnatural in lots of ways, it was nonetheless fascinating to many people in Rome why Christians lived the way they did, why they acted the way they did. The persecution through this period, we talked about the character of persecution last time, the kind of general background persecution that Christians always had, so we won't go into all of that again. But first of all, we talked last time mostly about Jewish persecution. Jewish persecution was the major feature of persecution through the first century. Jews continued to persecute Christians whenever they got the opportunity to do so, but especially after 135 AD, the ability of the Jews to officially persecute Christians pretty much came to an end. They continued to do whatever they could. They would cause rumors. They would slander Christians. I think it was in 90 AD or so, the Council of Yamnia, it was a Jewish council. They adopted as one of the prayers, the official prayers that were prayed at every synagogue, every Sabbath meeting of the synagogue, was a curse on the Nazarene and all his followers. So the Jews, there are many Jews who continue to pray that today, by the way, Orthodox Jews. So every Sunday, every Jew would pray a curse on the Nazarene and all his followers. There was a long-standing hostility. Nonetheless, as I said, their ability to cause trouble for the Christians mostly ended after 135 AD. The pagans, as Christianity became more prominent, pagan persecution was initially just because the Christians to the pagans were so weird. That they didn't engage in the cultural activities that everybody just took for granted. And in fact, not only did they not engage in those things, but they spoke out against them. They denounced the games for their cruelty and barbarism. They denounced the exposure of children. Again, irrelevant, you know, how many people hate Christians today because we're against abortion. Well, they hated Christians for that same thing back in the first century. There was a statement in the Didache, one of our very earliest documents of standard instruction into Christian faith, which stated that Christians have to be against abortion. Yes, abortion was possible in the ancient world. They'd use certain drugs and herbs and things like that, or other methods. Abortion happened then, and it was denounced by Christian, as well as the exposure of unwanted infants. They denounced the immorality and the violence of Roman culture, and all of those things made pagans not like them. Called them haters of humanity. They spread rumors. One thing the early Christians did, which was probably ill-advised, and that later generations changed course on, was a lot of what the Christians did in terms of their worship service was secret. You'd have to get permission to go into a Christian worship service. There would be deacons that would guard the door, or the entrance so when they talk about first of all, they would call everybody brother and sister. They would even call, like you call your wife sister or your husband brother, but you're calling everybody else brother and sister too. There were rumors of immorality and incest and orgies and things like that. There was also rumors of cannibalism. Because of the Lord's Supper, and they eat the body and blood of Christ, and they didn't, you know, understand or acknowledge that that was a symbolic thing, that they weren't actually eating so that there were rumors of them killing and eating babies, for example, things like that, that pagans would spread. Early in the second century, we have a really important document called the Pliny's Letter to Trajan. Pliny was a local governor in, I didn't have it written down, but I believe Asia Minor. Bithynia, which was in Asia. He wrote a letter to the Emperor Trajan asking what to do about a group of Christians that he'd found. He didn't really know anything about Christians, but had found a group of them that had come across his attention. He arrested two of their deaconesses and tortured them and reported to Trajan what he found out. He found out that he says, I don't know what to do with them. They won't engage in the various practices. All they seem to do is to gather together at an appointed time before dawn and sing hymns to a man named Christ as God. Otherwise, it wasn't clear what they should do with them. So he was asking, and there was various other things he said about he learned about Christian practice. And so he wasn't sure what he should do. And so Trajan wrote him back and said that he shouldn't actively seek Christians out. They appeared mostly to be harmless, but that if they were denounced and if they came to his attention and they wouldn't renounce it because they wouldn't engage in emperor worship, he should execute them. So it was kind of a don't ask, don't tell kind of policy that actually became the official policy of the Roman Empire for most of the next two centuries. That was always the policy. Now, there were exceptions. There were times when particular emperors really went on campaigns for various reasons. But most of the time, as long as Christians kind of kept their heads down and didn't attract too much attention, I don't want to downplay it. You can imagine what it would be like to think that if it just so happened that some neighbor of yours or some coworker decided he wanted your job or your house, and so he went and denounced you to the local governor, then you'd get executed, you and your family. You can imagine what that would make, the kind of background fear you would be living in all the time. Or if a mob rampaged through because there had been a plague or there had been a loss in battle or something like that, and a mob rampaged, decided to scapegoat the Christians, something that happened regularly, and you might get beat up and your house get burned down, and that all the local magistrates are just like, people need to blow off steam, and nothing would happen. And that was the thing that would regularly happen. But when we think of the really, Christians getting rounded up and thrown into the Colosseums and so forth, that happened often enough that most Christians would have living memory of it. Most Christians would know people who had died in those things, but it didn't happen all the time. And when it did happen, it usually ended fairly, within a year or two. Marcus Aurelius was probably the first big one. Marcus Aurelius lived in the middle of the second century. He was one of the best emperors that Rome ever had. A man of impeccable personal character. Did not engage. He was a Stoic. He did not engage in the immorality or the corruption. It was a man of great personal discipline by all accounts. A lot of his writings survive. As I said before, it was often the best emperors that were the worst persecutors of Christianity. The guys like Caligula, they were engaged in these constant orgies and all those kinds of things. They usually didn't care very much what the Christians were doing. It was the reformers that you really had to watch out for. Marcus Aurelius, looking at Rome was going through one of its periodic bad times, and Aurelius was really wanting to restore Rome to its old glory, and in order to do that, one of the things that he said was that sacrifice to the gods was mandatory. Everybody had to sacrifice to the gods. He said that flowing from good Stoic philosophy, he said that trying to influence people's behavior on the basis of rewards or punishment in the afterlife was a death penalty offense. Stoics very much believe that you should do good just for its own sake. And to say, well, to talk about heaven or hell then, would be trying to manipulate people. And he made it a death penalty offense. There were a lot of, a lot of persecutions during that period, a lot of executions and so forth. Church leaders especially would often be exiled, might be enslaved, would lose their property, lose their homes, things like that. It only went on again a couple of years before Marcus Aurelius died. It is a curious fact that every single emperor who initiated a really active persecution against the Christian church ended up dying in just a couple of years. There was an outbreak under Decius and Valerian, 249, 250 AD. That was the next really serious one. So that was like most of the first half of the third century was pretty peaceful. Christianity kind of entered into a de facto toleration period there. That's the first time we see the church starting to build a lot of buildings, for example. Churches actually had, people make a big deal about the fact, oh, the early, we shouldn't have all these buildings. Early churches just met in people's homes and in caves and things like that. And that's true. But the fact is that really as soon as the early church was able to do so, they started building spaces designed for worship. And if anybody's ever tried to worship in a community building, for example, having a space that's actually designed for worship is a good thing. It's valuable. The church obviously can meet wherever it can meet, and it doesn't need a custom designed worship space, but it's nice to have one. And the church, like I said, the church built spaces for itself as soon as it was able to do so. But then, yeah, 249, 250, it got really quite a bit more severe. Again, it was the same issue. It was a time of great instability. It was the crisis of the third century when the Roman Empire appeared to be splitting. Decius was trying to bring it all back together. Emperor worship was a common tool used to try and unite the empire. You think if all these people have all these different religions, and they did, all the different ethnic groups that were brought into the Roman Empire, they didn't attempt to make everybody worship the same gods. And that was actually part of the early success of the Roman Empire was that they allowed a lot of leeway in terms of people maintaining their own culture and political systems and so forth under the umbrella of Rome. So what they would do is they say, okay, yeah, you can worship whatever god you want. And really, up until 249, there really wasn't an attempt to say, you can't be a Christian. What it was to say, you have to worship the emperor. You can be a Christian, but you also have to worship the emperor. And it's like, if that's a problem for you, well, that's your problem. It's not our problem, So Decius really does start to target Christians, though, in particular. Seeing the growing Christian force as a threat to the stability and the unity of the Roman Empire. And a slander against the gods. He was, again, one of these pious old Romans who wanted to, look back at the glory of old Rome and thinks, we need to go back to the worship. It was the worship of the gods that made us great and unified and all those things. And so they wanted to, make Rome great again. And so they did. And so that's what he did. And that was a period of, there was widespread enslavement of Christianity. If you were a non-Roman citizen, especially, you would be subject to enslavement. If you were a Roman citizen, you might lose your citizenship. If you were a church, leaders were usually executed. Bishops. There were a lot of churches were required to turn over their Bibles, and other Christian writings, so that they could be burned. There was a big debate in the Roman church, in the Roman Empire, after 312, because the same thing happened under Diocletian. There was a big discussion of whether a bishop who had willingly turned over Bibles to Rome to be burned could ever be reinstated to the office of bishop. Whether a person, it was viewed as an intense betrayal of the church. Because Bibles were rare, and Bibles were expensive and difficult to copy. And so if you turned a Bible over to the authorities to be burned in order to save your life, there were many who said such a man should never, there were many who said such a man could never even be regarded as a Christian again. That was a big discussion about how to deal with, because as we said before, not everybody was equally brave. You know, not everybody was equally forthright, and under the pressure of torture, under the threat of death, people recanted. They did. They denounced Christianity, and then later felt bad about it and wanted to come back. And you know, so the church was debating, often debated, should we let them back? And where they usually ended up, it seemed like they landed, was that yes, you could let them back into the church, but you could not let them back into church office. They couldn't hold church office. They couldn't be pastors or bishops ever again, or elders, if they denounced the faith under the pressure of torture or other pressures. Decius didn't live long again. And then it was his successor, Valerian, who followed on. And the edicts of Decius and Valerian stayed in place for, which was, again, an act of persecution. People were required to. Decius did something new. Decius had, I forget the term for it, but the citizens had to offer sacrifices to the emperor every year, and in doing so they'd get a certificate. Domitian had done something, tried to do something similar back at the end of the first century, but it didn't stick, and it wasn't, but Decius really made it stick. He really made it the widespread practice that you would get a certificate testifying that you had offered sacrifices to the emperor. And if you didn't have that certificate, then you were subject to, you had to show your papers whenever you traveled, whenever you tried to import, export goods or engage in trade or anything like that, or travel from one place to another. They would ask for your certificate. And if you didn't have it, you could get arrested and executed possibly, or other. During the time of Galerius Maximus, this was under the persecution of Decius. Galerius Maximus was a local governor. He'd arrest a man named Thasius Cyprianus. Cyprian. And we have a transcript of his trial. It went like this. Galerius Maximus, are you Thasius Cyprianus? Cyprian says, yes, I am. Galerius, the most sacred emperors have commanded you to conform to the Roman rites. Cyprian, I refuse. Galerius, take heed to yourself. Cyprian, do as you are bid. In so clear a case, I may not take heed. Galerius, after briefly conferring with his judicial council with much reluctance, pronounced the following sentence. You have long lived an irreligious life and have drawn together a number of men bound by an unlawful association and profess yourself an open enemy to the gods and the religion of Rome. And the pious, most sacred, and august emperors have endeavored in vain to bring you back to conformity with their religious observances. Whereas, therefore, you have been apprehended as principal and ringleader in these infamous crimes, you shall be made an example to those whom you have wickedly associated with you. The authority of law shall be ratified in your blood. He then read the sentence of the court from a written table. It is the sentence of this court that Thasius Cyprianus be executed with the sword. Cyprian, thanks be to God. And he was publicly executed. One thing that sometimes people remark on, sometimes secular critics who try and downplay the Roman persecutions would bring up examples of cases where Roman authorities begged Christians to renounce. Really tried to convince them. And you say, see, they didn't want to execute them. They didn't want to do these things. It's just the Christians were such jerks, you know. And what they don't understand, what they don't see about that, is that, no, of course, the persecution, they never wanted to kill Christians. What they wanted, they didn't want corpses. They wanted compliant citizens. They wanted people to knuckle under and do as they were told. The goal of persecution is never execution. The goal of persecution is compliance. Execution is just what they do when everything else fails. So the fact that you have so many, and you do, you have lots of testimonies of Roman governors anxiously pleading and trying very hard to convince Christians to renounce their faith. I mean, why that should be a point in Rome's favor, I don't know, but that's kind of, sometimes that's the argument you hear. Oh. Why don't we go ahead and quit there? Are there any questions? We'll take up the kind of the final end of things, and then we'll look at some other aspects of this period. We'll look at the last persecution and the end of persecution in Rome, and then we'll look at some of the important figures and issues going on in the time. Any questions or comments?
I was thinking how when the church spread, initially, how much more excitement there must have been with these events of Christ being sacrificed and dying on the cross for us, happening so recently.
Yeah.
As opposed to maybe how we view it today.
It feels kind of remote to us, doesn't it? Or it can. Yeah. Especially to people who would see frequently what crucifixion was actually like. They would actually, you know, it was a common occurrence in the Roman Empire. You know, you would have probably seen people be crucified. No. Other questions or comments? Okay, well, let's go ahead and close in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for preserving your church through all the years, and thank you for what you've done for your kingdom and for your son and for your people. Thank you for preserving this information that we can be inspired by and understand and learn from, how to respond to the difficulties of our own age, the particular challenges and trials that we face. Lord, we pray that you continue to preserve your church, continue to glorify your son, Jesus Christ, by spreading his kingdom throughout the world. And we pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.